everyone feels really close, makes me want to go back out. best I don't do that. Might set a wrong example. Okay, so on this series of Saturday mornings, we've started to look at the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and a couple of weeks ago, Amma Pushpa introduced us to the overall theme and evoked the whole aspect of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The following week, Dharma Sri opened us up to Avalokiteshvara, and we walked into the realm of Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of love and compassion. There's a clue on the shrine as to who we're going to be looking at this morning. I'll say more about that figure in due course. But before we look at Manjushri, to give the name away, just a few general words about these Bodhisattvas. I'm thinking about this last night, thinking of the Buddha. So in the Buddha's career as a Bodhisattva, he accumulated boundless good deeds, one of the things that he did over multiple lifetimes. And as he accumulated all these boundless good deeds, they sort of clung around him. You could almost see it perhaps as an aura. So all these deeds just clung around him. And that came to be known in Buddhist terms, it's a big technical word, Sambhogakaya in Buddhism, which translates in about 20 different ways. It's really unhelpful, but it's something like body of glory, body of experience, subtle body of limitless form is one translation that I wrote down. It doesn't really tell me very much. But Sangharakshita kind of nails it, and he kind of suggests this is a sort of Punyakaya, which is an existence based on meritorious deeds. So all the good work that the Buddha, when he was a Bodhisattva, had done, all that clung around him as an aura in this Punyakaya, based on all the punya, all the merit that he had accumulated through the deeds that he'd done. And it's important to kind of point out that we don't regard these archetypal Bodhisattvas as real, in a sense of they're not individual personalities, but we regard them as different aspects of this Sambhogakaya. And each Bodhisattva has a specific function, as we were introduced to in the last couple of weeks, wisdom, compassion, and so on. But the Sambhogakaya, this body of experiences, is all of these aspects together, all of these aspects woven into one. But it's also important to point out that these archetypal figures, they're more than just mere symbols. I guess we could say they're more dynamic images that reveal the wisdom, that reveal the compassion, the potency of the Buddha nature that empowers each of these figures. So this week, as I mentioned, we're going to be looking specifically at Manjushri. We've got this wonderful rupa on the shrine. And Manjushri represents wisdom. Not sure I'm fully qualified to talk about wisdom, but we'll unpack it through the morning and see what happens. You'll also hear the name Manjugosha. Manjugosha is a manifestation of Manjushri. The two names are often used interchangeably. Manju literally means gentle, so I've forgotten that for a minute. Manju means gentle. Also soft or auspicious. Gosha, kind of should know what that means because it's in my order name, Amma Gosha. Gosha is speech or voice. So Manjugosha is he of gentle voice or the sweet voice. Manjushri, very similar, but it's more translated as gentle glory or the greatly auspicious one. But one of the key word there is really Manju, that gentleness. Which is quite a contrast when you look at it. He's got this big sword in his hand. We'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Also known by lots of other names, so known as Wenshu in China, Monju in Japan, which is quite similar to Manju, the gentle bit, and Jamyang or Jampal in Tibetan. Literally Jamyang in Tibetan means gentle friend. So it's quite a good response to that word Manju. In Tibetan, it literally is gentle. That bit jam is gentle, so it's quite nice. It's
so quite palace.
Palace gentle.
Palace.
Is it? They got
not
the right
friend.
Way around? Not friend. Okay. So it's quite a nice image. So when I was looking it up last night, thinking, well, jam's quite nice. You can buy it off the shelves. this kind of concept of gentle jam that you could kind of have. A couple of other names that Manjushri goes by, Vakishvara or Vagishvara, which literally means Lord of Speech. Now, that's another popular name and one that's evoked in quite a few texts. So those in the know, the scholars, tell us that Manjushri is perhaps the oldest and one of the most significant bodhisattva figures in Mahayana literature. And it's significant in that Manjushri has perhaps the closest association of all the bodhisattvas with the Buddha. And one of the reasons for that is because Manjushri is one of a trinity of protectors, along with Vajrapani and Avalokiteshvara, I didn't forget, that protects the Tathagata family, which includes the historical Buddha Shakyamuni. So he's one of that trinity of protectors that look after the family of Shakyamuni. There's also a really scary side to Manjushri. So Yamantaka is the wrathful form of Manjushri, in Tibetan Buddhism especially. And as Yamantaka, Manjushri assumes this fierce, blue-black, bull-headed form to defeat Yama, the Lord of Death. And there's a bit of a backstory to this. So the story goes that once there was a holy man practicing meditation in a cave, I'm not sure where, and he was the unintentional witness of the slaughter of a stolen bull by two thieves. When the thieves became aware of this holy man's presence, they immediately chopped off his head as well. But to the terrified amazement of these thieves, the victim reached out and lifted up the dripping head of the bull and placed it on his own severed head. It's a pretty scary figure. And his vengeful intent led him to devour the thieves, but also awakened in him this insatiable thirst for human blood, which threatened the entire population of the area. I didn't want to wear a bull's head, that would just be weird. But the people in the local area appealed to Manjushri, who, assuming an even fiercer form than that of Yama, put an end to the bloodshed. So that's a bit of a backstory around the kind of wrathful form of Manjushri. But I guess we should come back to the gentler form of Manjushri, that we see on the shrine. He normally appears as yellow or golden yellow or orange in colour, although there's also images of Manjushri either in black or white as well. Not the pictures, but the colour of Manjushri. In his right hand, as you can see, he holds a double-edged flaming sword, which is very symbolic in Buddhism. It symbolises his ability to cut through the notions of duality, to cut away greed, cut away hatred, cut away delusion. But the flames are also, the flames suggest that the sword is not a literal one. It's not a real sword that he went around slicing off people's heads with. In Buddhism, flames often represent transformation. And ignorance is not so much destroyed as it's transformed. So that's what we're looking at there. We don't destroy ignorance in a sense. We transform it gradually over time. And it might seem somewhat violent appearance, as I mentioned earlier on, with the sword. That doesn't go with his gentle name, Manju, meaning gentle. But it's this actual contrast that directs us to think again about the true nature of wisdom. And remember, Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He has a spiritual softness. There's no hardness there. There's no rigidity there whatsoever. He is the embodiment of transcendental wisdom. And he represents this subtle, gentle wisdom, but as Sangharakshita says, it's also a devastating wisdom. So it's that real paradox of being both gentle and soft, but also devastating. It can just break through. It can just cut through that greed, that hatred, and that delusion. And the Sutra builds on those words by Sangharakshita, and he actually says that any radical transformation involves a degree of violence. So any radical transformation involves a degree of violence. And I think if we look at our own lives, and perhaps those of us that have been coming to the centre for for some time. Often transformation is painful. It's not as if it's an easy thing to do. As we transform, we're breaking down often years, tens of years of conditioning, years of learned behaviour, and we are changing ourselves in a fundamental way. So I think that's very true. Those words from Basantra are really ring true. You know, any radical transformation involves a degree of violence. In his left hand, near his heart, on quite a few figures, there's a lotus, a lotus flower, and that supports what we call the Pranyapanamata texts, the perfection of wisdom teaching. And those texts represent, I guess you could say, the ultimate realization from the blossoming of wisdom. And he holds those texts close to his heart, normally, because he knows that wisdom is the most precious of all possessions. So that's the distinction of the sword in one hand and the lotus flower and the text in the other. And like most bodhisattvas, he's seated on a lotus flower, which grows from the mud, yet remains entirely unstained by the mud. And the lotus therefore represents the purity of wisdom. Sometimes Manjushri's also shown seated upon a lion. So all bodhisattvas' figures are associated with an animal. Manjushri is associated with a lion. And that represents the use of wisdom to tame the mind. So there's the whole image of Manjushri atop a lion, and it's symbolic for being able to tame the mind, taming the lion, taming the mind. Manjushri is also called Kumara Bhuta, which would translate as something like he who has become a youth, or he who is youthful. And he's always represented as being beautiful, usually 16 years old, and never growing old. And there's reasons for that, very common sense reasons. It's because wisdom is like that. Wisdom is always fresh, it's always new, it's always young, it's never stale. You can never go tired of true wisdom. I guess you would say the beauty and the magic never fades. And in contrast, you know, while the unenlightened mind sees the unenlightened mind would typically see life as being ordinary. To those who are awakened, to those who have manifested true wisdom, life is magic, extraordinary, and full of potential. So I'm going to say a few words about the mantra of Manjushri. So again, all the figures, all the bodhisattvas have a mantra. Mantra translates as protector of the mind, something which helps us to protect our mind, to help our mind to develop. Most of you will be aware the mantra for Manjushri is Om Narapashana Dihi. The last bit, Di or Dihi, is a C syllable, and it's a C syllable that's associated with wisdom. There's a big long technical description of the earlier bit of the mantra, so the five syllables, Arapachana. I'm not going to go into that because I didn't understand it when I read it either. I'm not going to teach what I don't understand. But those five syllables, Arapachana, they're the first five letters of what is known as the alphabet of perfect wisdom. And as I said, there's big long descriptions going through each syllable and what they mean. Broadly, it's associated with emptiness and impermanence, but it's not kind of the purpose of what we're looking at. So Manjushri himself features in many Mahayana texts, some of which you'll know, the Vimalakirtana Desha, Lotus Sutra, Pranyapanamata Sutra, Avatamsaka Sutra, Gandavyuha Sutra, and many others. It appears in lots and lots of texts. He was a busy chap, obviously. but he also has a key role in some important tantras as well. So, for example, the Manjushri Namasangiti Tantra, quite a well-known Tibetan text. But the idea of wisdom as the principal tool on the path to awakening did not originate, as some suggest, with the Mahayana Pranyapanamata texts. it's already deeply embedded in the teachings of early Buddhism. There's lots and lots and lots about it in the suttas, in the early canon. So it wasn't something that was invented with the Mahayana strand of Buddhism, but I would say that, having a slight prevalence towards early Buddhism. And in the words of the Buddha, there are amongst these four lights. What four? The light of the moon, the light of the sun, the light of fire, and the light of wisdom. Of these four lights, the light of wisdom is supreme. So it seems like a good point to move on and look a bit more at wisdom. I may not be a fully qualified guide, but we'll journey on this together and see where we end up. So the word wisdom, panya in Pali or pranya in Sanskrit, translates literally as wisdom, but also as reason, as insight, as discernment, knowledge. A longer translation would be insight into the true nature of reality. And what we mean by that is seeing the lakshanas, the marks of existence, of anicca, of anatta, of dukkha, of impermanence, impersonality, and unsatisfactoriness. It means we see the truth of those marks of existence. We see impermanence as a liberating insight. And this wisdom shines the light on our clinging, but also on our aversion. And as I said, panya, wisdom, is usually translated as such, as wisdom. But it's closer in meaning, in a sense, to insight. It means knowing or understanding not as a possession, not as my wisdom, not as something that I own, but more as an action. It's the act of knowing, the act of understanding, the act of discernment, of discerning. So it's something that we actively do. It's more of a verb than a noun, in a sense, and you know, panya in Pali is actually a noun. But there's a verb that appears in loads of Buddhist texts about wisdom, pajanati, which literally translates as one understands. And that conveys this active sense of knowing. When you read the text in Pali, that pajanati just appears again and again and again and again. And it is one understands. So it's that active sense of knowing, as I mentioned. And I suppose wisdom in a direct sense is the culmination of Buddhist practice. To quote the Sutta again, Buddhism's basic aim is to eradicate ignorance by developing transcendental wisdom. And Buddha Ghosha in the Visuddha Magga states that the function of wisdom is to abolish the darkness of delusion. So wisdom is this essential tool to put out those fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. But what does wisdom really mean in our lives? What's the purpose? What's the benefit? How do we attain wisdom? The purpose I just alluded to, and as the Sutta suggested there, the purpose is to eradicate ignorance. It's to crack open our perspective and put out those fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So how do we attain wisdom? You know, it's not something we can buy off the shelf. I guess there's quite a few ways, and you know, those that have been coming here for a while, it's something that we all work on together in different ways. One absolutely essential practice is what we did earlier. It's meditation. Every time we sit, we create the opportunity to see more clearly, to know things as they really are. We create the potential to become more mindful in everything that we do. So the immediate condition for the arising of wisdom is concentration. And we train our minds in that sense through meditation. Other ways, as well as meditation, that we can move in this direction, going on retreat. That's another very important aspect of our practice. Both with others and with solitary. I love solitaries. I promised my preceptor this year, I would not do a solitary. Done pretty well so far. I love solitaries. I find public retreats a bit tougher because there's people. And I promised I wouldn't do a solitary this year, and I haven't done, so full marks to me. I am going on a public retreat in December as well. So it's kind of, I've committed to not doing a solitary. But retreats are really good because they put us in different conditions to everyday life. Hopefully we're like-minded people. We're able to do more study, to do more meditation with less distraction, hopefully. Our mind will come and battle us out when we go on retreat, but it's the changing of conditions that helps us to understand ourselves and life a little bit better. Study is really useful. It's a really good way of not just learning new things we haven't come across before, but understanding some of the stuff that we do know already. Another really good tool that we all have, that we have right now, is Sangha. Also spiritual friendship, because it's our interaction with each other, it's how we are with each other, it's the things that we can learn from each other. All that helps move us in this direction. Associated with that is reflection. It's another useful practice that we can do just to see where we are. That's why at the end of a period of meditation, it's quite helpful if we can just sit for a couple of minutes and just reflect on that practice. How was I before? How was I afterwards? How am I now? What's going on for me? What do I feel in the body? So the still mind is the foundation for insight. And I guess we can move towards that through some of these practices that I just mentioned. There's also another really good practice that I heartily recommend. It's called Just Living. Just Living. Really good practice. You all do it every day anyway. But it's very helpful. And if we bring mindfulness into that, it really helps us to realise more of the beauty, more of the fullness of life, more of the potential, more of what's really going on, how we're more reactive and less responsive, and trying to flip that over, try to respond, don't react. If we bring mindfulness fully into life, we can start to move that way. As our mindfulness increases, we get better acquainted, not just with ourselves, but with the world around us. And we begin to live a more authentic life. And I guess that's not always easy, certainly not in my experience, but it's always beneficial. Always. And one way that I've been exploring this, especially lately, is through allowing others to witness my vulnerability, just to see, hey, I'm not perfect. And you could say, in a sense, this is practicing vulnerability as an expression of the Dharma. It lets others see us. It gives us permission to let go of our masks, put down that facade. What it does mean is placing sufficient trust in the attention of others. So I'm willing to expose my vulnerabilities. I have to place my trust in others, trusting that they will not use my vulnerabilities against me. And it allows ourselves to be seen by others, to go to the emotional edge, I guess. And it's uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. But it's also worthwhile. Really worthwhile. Tough practice, but one that I'm finding both difficult and beneficial. And I'll say a bit more about the trust or faith in a bit. So bringing awareness and acceptance to the fore in our lives presents us with an opportunity. It's an opportunity, as I said earlier, to see how things really are. So it's by cultivating a kindly attitude to whatever arises, we begin to understand that mindfulness is an attitude towards experience. It's a way of relating to life that has the potential of enriching our life and making it more meaningful. And mindfulness leads to liberating insights. It leads directly to liberating wisdom. Don't take your mind so personal. I'm still working on that, but it's true. Don't take it so personal. Don't take yourself so seriously. The wise relationship to dukkha, to unpleasantness, to unsatisfactoriness, is not hatred, never hatred. It's compassion. Hate and pain is a dead end. And we constantly experience pleasure and pain. And mindfulness teaches that we can break our habitual aversive reaction to pain, and we can overcome our tendencies to cling to pleasure. We can practice non-attachment. We can develop compassion, acceptance, and tolerance. And we talk in Buddhism quite a lot about wisdom and compassion. And Dharma Sri, when she evoked Avalokiteshvara a couple of weeks back, spoke beautifully around compassion and the aspects of Avalokiteshvara. But wisdom is also paired in Buddhism with other qualities. So in the five spiritual faculties, for example, so faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. In the five spiritual faculties, wisdom is paired with faith or trust. Trust or confidence is another translation for sadha or shraddha. So faith, trust or confidence. I use faith because it's probably one you're most familiar with. So wisdom is paired with faith in the five spiritual faculties, whilst energy is paired with concentration. And these two pairings are both underpinned or supported by the fifth faculty, which is mindfulness. So wisdom and faith support, sustain, reinforce each other, but underpinned by mindfulness. And the Pali texts tell us that our aim is to equalize or balance the faculties so that faith and wisdom and energy and concentration may be held in a state of perfect equilibrium, I wish. But this can only be brought about by means of mindfulness. And mindfulness is the one faculty that does not go to extremes. It can never be too much mindfulness. And therefore, mindfulness doesn't require a counterbalancing faculty. It is a counterbalancing faculty. So all of that was just to say, meditate, because it's good for you, and it will make you more mindful. I mentioned earlier, so wisdom, literally in Pali, is a noun. And I thought I'd look up the English dictionary. Quite unusual for me, don't like English dictionaries. The quality of having experience, knowledge and good judgment. The quality of being wise. The key word for me there really is experience. We learn from our experiences, hopefully. We can grow from them. We verify in our own lives that what we intuited and reasoned is actually real, actually true. And Sangha actually talks of these three aspects of faith. Faith and wisdom being paired. So this intuitive response, this rational investigation, and this experiential verification. So we intuit something, we then investigate it more with our intellectual minds, and then we say, is that true in my experience, in my life? So these three aspects of faith are very relevant to how we live. And this experience is seeing the way things really are. Not how we perceive or conceive them to be. We drop the facade of concepts and allow ourselves to actually live our experience. Be present to receive life. And Jung, in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, wrote directly about concepts and experience. And he said, no one has any obligations to a concept, because concepts promise protection from experience. So he's saying that often we use a concept to protect us from something that's really going on. We'd rather stay in the conceptual land rather than the experiential land. So living from, to and in our experience is definitely the wiser way to live. But wisdom does need to be continually developed. It's not static. It's not just knowledge. It's not something we learn from books. It's not as if we can read something and suddenly we're instantly wise. Wouldn't that be nice? I can read this book, bing, I'm now wise. We might have learned something through reading books, and hopefully we do, but that's not wisdom. Wisdom is more than intuitive understanding that grows, that comes out of our experience. It's a movement from standing under something to understanding it, you could say. And what is meant by wisdom in Buddhism is a type of understanding that's far superior, as I mentioned, to something we learn in a book. What panya, what wisdom really signifies, is the understanding that arises through spiritual training. It illuminates the true nature of things and culminates in the mind's purification and liberation. So wisdom is not just bare intuition, but it's a careful, discriminative understanding. And it arises from an underlying matrix, I guess you could say, of causes and conditions. So as well as the five spiritual faculties that I touched on, wisdom makes an appearance in loads of other Buddhist lists. So there's the six paramitas, the six perfections, and wisdom is the sixth one of those. There's the ten paramitas, ten perfections, and wisdom is the fourth one of those. And the Eightfold Path itself is quite often subdivided into three sections, into ethics, into meditation, and into wisdom. And ethics is about right speech, right action, right livelihood. And meditation is about right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the wisdom aspects of the Eightfold Path is about right view and right intention. And a friend of mine who I studied Pali with summarises these three subdivisions of the Eightfold Path quite nicely. Clean up your act, concentrate your mind, and use your concentrated mind to investigate reality. Quite like that. So looking at where the Eightfold Path came from, it's the fourth Noble Truth. The Four Noble Truths define the purpose of wisdom. And the purpose of wisdom is explicit in the third Noble Truth, the cessation of suffering. Because the cessation of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, is nirvana, and that is the goal, ultimately, of wisdom. So wisdom in the 21st century, where we are now, has been, I think, somewhat devalued. In the past, it was our elders were respected as wise. They were the holders of knowledge due to their life experience, which they passed on to the next generation. And whilst that still happens to a degree, I guess, the internet, as one example, has changed how we learn. It's changed how we research. It's changed how we even relate to knowledge. We're encouraged, perhaps you could say, conditioned to seek instant gratification, to demand immediate answers to our questions. And how many times my daughters say to me, they ask me a totally random question that I would never know the answer to. And you think, and I just say, I'm sorry, I don't know. Well, Dad, Google's much more useful than you. And it's, yeah, thanks. Thanks, that makes me feel good. But actually, it's kind of true. You know, I can teach them certain life skills and stuff, hopefully, but when they ask some weird questions like, Dad, who sung so-and-so song in the 1970s? Oh, I don't know. But Google usually does. So it does change our relationship to knowledge. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think that mindful just living practice that I mentioned earlier, that's mm-hmm. overlooked. And people just think, actually, you know, is that really useful? Because we want answers now and we can get that from Google. I haven't got time to wait to live out my life and find the answers along the way, but hopefully you know that's not the case. So before I end, and we have time for a little group, so I just wanted to read a passage from the Samyutta Nikaya called A Handful of Leaves. It's quite a short passage, don't worry. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in a Simsapar grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Simsapar leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus, "What do you think, monks? Which is more numerous, these few leaves that I have in my hand or those in the grove overhead?" "Venerable Sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous." "So too, monks, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous." while the things I have taught you are few. And why, monks, have I not taught these many things? Because they are without benefit, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Therefore, I have not taught them. And what, monks, have I taught? I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why, monks, have I taught this? Because this is beneficial. This is relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life and leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Therefore, I have taught this. Therefore, monks, an exertion should be made to understand. This is suffering. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And I suppose we could go on talking about developing and understanding wisdom in Buddhism for a long time, I suspect. And we could examine it from lots of different perspectives, different angles. There's some really exciting work being done in neuroscience, for example, that's looking at which parts of the brain are more receptive to learning and development and to where we would see wisdom. But I'm opposed to go into that. I think, as the Buddha suggested in that passage, I think we're better off putting into practice what we know of the Buddha's teachings already. This will help us to progress. It will help us to be kinder, more compassionate, more mindful. It also makes us more receptive for further teachings. All of which sounds to me like this is laying the solid, unshakable foundations for living a wiser life. For embracing the Buddha's teachings in itself is a wise and noble thing to do. It's a good decision that many of us have made to actually follow the Dharma. That's a wise decision. And it enables a simple, basic, wiser way of being in the world. So I think I'll end it there. Thank you.